Hello there, Jerry and Matt. It's Gwyneth Paltrow. It's amazing to finally be joining you on Art Smack. I would have loved to have been here sooner, but I am dealing with this ridiculous lawsuit right now. It's not really on brand with pre-pandemic Goop to be this litigious and petty, but since being stuck in one of my numerous homes due to that nasty little disease that kept me from all of my usual expensive vacationing, I'm feeling a bit more trifling than usual. Previously, everything was just beige and vaginal jade eggs and good fun. Now, if my mood were a haircut, it would be characterized as early 2000 Kate Gosselin. I want to speak to the manager of the world after this ski collision that I didn't consent to and made me lose half a day of skiing, which is a lot when you're a woman of my stature. I know you can't relate, but try to empathize with me. Anyway, I'm suing this guy for $1 just to prove a point, though I'm not really sure to whom, but it's been really stressing me out putting my victim looks together for court. The only good thing is that I've lost tons of weight naturally from pure rage and disgust. So, I've given my dose of Ozempic to someone who needs it. But let's talk about why I'm here today, because honestly, Jerry, you're hilarious, but the Ruth Asawa jokes have to stop. Let me be real with you, I'm the original child of nepotism, and if you can't tell, I didn't go to high school, and I can't even remember the last time I finished a book. I pay people California minimum wage at Goop to summarize things. So how the hell was I supposed to know who Ruth Asawa was? I thought those were elegant Japanese fisherman nets or something. So when someone told me I could buy the dupe for a quarter of the price by one of her apprentices, obviously, you don't get rich by just giving your money away. How was I supposed to know I'd get caught by the art world when Architectural Digest turned my home? I mean, talk about petty. And if you really want to go there, keep making memes about my fake Ruth Asawa, and I might just see you in court.
Welcome back to Art Smack. This is episode 19. I'm your host, Matt, and I'm here with
Jerry Gagosian.
Jerry, are you feeling that spring weather? Feels like...
Yeah, actually, I am.
Feels like we've turned the page. We are reborn, like a Botticelli painting, and you are the Venus in the oyster shell.
Aw.
Just kidding. You are one of the gust people blowing wind.
Hey, actually... I was about to comment on that I hope you all are working on your Basel bodies because, you know, TikTok, it's almost April. We've got to get to June. You've got to look good in your designer clothes when you get to the mezzoplots. And we all know that good designers don't put spandex or polyester in their clothes, so that means no stretch, kids.
That means fire up that Ozempic, baby. Get it going.
No, that means put your running shoes on and get to the gym, or in my case, get your ass out on the streets, start exercising, and unroll that yoga mat that was...
Collecting dust.
A little bit of dust.
Well, we got a great show for you guys this week. We are going to talk about what's going on over in Hong Kong. Last week was Hong Kong Art Basel, and we're going to unpack a decision that Jerry made about going back to business school, which is super exciting. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Art Smack.
Welcome back.
So the art world turned its attention to Hong Kong this week for Hong Kong Art Basel. Or is it Art Basel, Hong Kong? That's probably
art
the right
Basel,
way to say it.
Hong Kong.
So the art world descended upon that island.
It's the coast of mainland China.
Yeah, and that's going to come up in this conversation. So yes, Art Basel, Hong Kong took place. The results came back. It was a blockbuster success. I mean, any article, any publication talked about how much the dealer sold how successful it was, how many celebrities popped in, how all the collectors were happy, the museums were there. It was buzzing. Mm-hmm. So, Jerry, what does this mean for the art world, the big picture here? Business as usual? I feel like we're coming across this quite often now, right? It's like every fair is like, it's great. Everything's great.
I don't believe every time they say a fair is great. But I believe this fair was financially great. And I think that this is a very interesting moment for, I don't know exactly how to say this, but wealth transference from Europe and the US into Asia.
Right.
And I think that, like, you know, as you know, I've mentioned, you know, the art world is a little mise en scene, and you know, this is just a little blip for us to watch and see how, you know, the economics of things shake out. I thought that this was a very clear indication, because guess whose banks are not in trouble right now? Guess who's not having massive inflation issues right now? Hong Kong, China, like they're...
Singapore.
Yeah. Taiwan.
Yeah. Well, something you said, I'll expand it for the audience. I think we've mentioned on the podcast before, but Jerry and I were talking to a very prominent art advisor once, and she spoke about the trend of wealth in the art world. And that the story starts in the 20th century when masterpieces from Europe, mm-hmm. after World War II, were imported effectively into the United States, into collectors' hands and the wealthy here. Mm-hmm. And that the story of the 21st century is going to be the flow of those, a lot of same works, but also the newer works created, ending up in Asia. So it kind of transferred from Europe to the Americas, and then now it's moving over to Asia. And like, yeah. We've seen many examples of this going back to even auction records, where it's always like some Japanese or some Chinese billionaire bought that Monet, that Van Gogh, that Basquiat. And then now it's, they bought that Emily May Smith, that Loie Hollowell, that Shara Hughes. Mm-hmm. This is the dynamic that we're seeing now. And that, you know, this is why China has rapidly been climbing in the largest art centers rankings, having overtaken Great Britain a few years ago, and it's not looking back.
Right. And there's this interesting thing that I think that we'll begin to see more of, which is the, let's call it like the rebalancing of the Western art narrative versus the Eastern art narrative. Because for so long, there's been a disjuncture, and because Western art has been the more sort of dominant art form, at least in terms of the market, mm-hmm. for so long, they've really controlled the narrative, right? And now all of a sudden, you know, yes, there were all the big major Western galleries there. There were also very important Asian galleries, totally. That were there. And like the Museum M Plus, which is like a, from what I've heard and what I've read, it's like a world class, like incredible museum, like put on an amazing exhibition. Like, just there was so much going on. But I mean, are the Western dealers gonna have to become just as fluent in like Southeast Asian art history as they are in, you know, European art history? Is that going to become like necessary? Because I mean, these are giant markets. And if they want to get some of that gravy, you know, they're going to have to kowtow to their clientele. And yeah, I'm sure for now they're very interested in a lot of Western contemporary art.
New York artists, LA artists.
Yeah, but that's not going to be forever.
Yeah, the domestic home pride might kick in, right? And then who's there to service that need? Is it Zwirner, or is it, you know, an Asian gallery to be there? But thinking about this from an auction house's perspective, which are important signifiers in our art world cycle, a lot of these big collections that come up are almost exclusively from American and European industrialists, entrepreneurs, the wealthy, socialites. That's the named collection. It's Lee Radzwell, it's Adam Lindemann, it's the Marins, it's, what was the big one, Macklow. Like, and anyone from Christie's or Sotheby's who's listening, let me know. Has there been the named collection from the great Hong Kong families or the Taiwanese families? Like, have they elevated those collections, which probably now rival many of the stuff that's coming, that's mm-hmm. owned in the West, right? Have they elevated those collections to that evening sale prominence, where they still feel like it's a little taboo or something? Be curious to see how that unfolds.
Yeah. Maybe over there. Maybe not over here. I don't know.
Does a collector over there have that kind of name, star power? Even though the works, I mean, you think about the collections that have formed there in the last 50 years, it's unbelievable. Some of the best works of art have gone over to Asia.
Yes. The other thing that I think is interesting to watch, and I did participate in Art Basel Hong Kong this year in the sense that I gave an online Zoom talk.
Yeah, baby. Like
the lamest possible way to participate. I mean, it was fun, whatever, but it was not like going. I really want to go next year. I want to see it. I want to see it with my own eyes. And what I'm very, 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 very interested in is the pageantry that comes along with what I have seen the Hong Kong art scene to have. Because, you know, one of my closest friends lives in Hong Kong and is constantly sending me pictures of art world events and openings and art fairs. And it's like, it just blasts, like, even the most, like, pretentious opening day of Art Basel in Switzerland. It just, like, blasts it out of the water. I mean, you can't even... You could drown in the Birkin bags, you know, like it's just so crazy. And the clothes are, I mean, they dress to go to these things. And
because,
like,
it's families coming from Singapore and Taiwan and South Korea and mainland China. And it's not just like the local scene in Hong Kong that goes there. It's a huge event for the entire continent.
Right. But I mean, it's like amazing. I have to say I have some like respect for that because I'm so tired of us sloppy ass Americans and our sloppy ass like athleisure and jeans and like I just want to be comfortable thing. Like I see these like men and women like doing a little more than rolling out of bed to go to an art
the bare fair. Minimum.
Yeah, and like it makes it so enticing. And I always remember, like, those were the things I was attracted to in the beginning when I wanted to, like, go into art, right? It's, like, this extreme level of, like, pageantry that we all sort of ignore or pretend, like, is not there. But it really is a procession, you know? And it's, like, everyone has their place in it. And when my friend sends me pictures of like stuff going on at M Plus. I mean, I can't even think of it. Looks like the Oscars.
You mean it doesn't look like NADA? at 1 o'clock on in the day two.
Yeah.
Yeah. We'd be remiss if we didn't mention the geopolitical side of this, which is a little trickier to get into. But Hong Kong has had years of unrest geopolitically. And in 2019, there was a movement by a number of Western art galleries against the government of Hong Kong and the art scene of Hong Kong, where they issued a letter saying that they would not participate in Art Basel Hong Kong at that time due to what they perceived was crackdowns on free rights and protests by, you know, people, the population in Hong Kong. If you guys recall, there was a lot of unrest.
Yeah. And so then people were freaking out because they were going to lose freedom of speech, because the freedom of speech does not exist in China. It doesn't. I'm not just throwing that out there. That's a fact. And yeah, and there's still like been, a, you know, things that, I mean, listen, if it's not the what is it? The kettle calling the pot black or whatever. I mean, America it doesn't really get to point its fingers on how it treats and surveils its own civilians. But, you know, the way that China has dealt with the COVID situation has also been under, you know, a great deal of scrutiny in the, you know, global public eye, yet, you know, obviously nothing is done about it because China is so large and powerful at this point, and you don't fuck with China.
Yeah. So the art galleries, going back to that 2019-2020 protests, you know, they say that they would not participate. I believe what ended up happening was the, you know, COVID-19 pandemic came and that Art Basel was turned virtual. And by default, a lot of the protest movements that had happened there because of the pandemic had silenced effectively. They were kept inside. But, you know, I bring this up because, you know, 3 years later, no problems, right? Everyone went there. And there was no trepidation from the Western dealers about going to Hong Kong, even though you could say that the problems that had been existing there have been exacerbated in the last few years.
Yeah, I would love to compare that list of like who went.
I'm sure they all went.
Who went and who signed that letter back in 20... It was 2020 when they wrote that letter.
Right, and yeah.
But, yeah, the good old art world virtue signaling, you know, that they didn't want to go amid, you know, some issues, and they all signed this letter. And then a few years later, you know, that... Nobody did well at Art Basel Miami Beach, so Lord knows we needed a healthy Art Basel to happen somewhere, and everyone went to Art Basel Hong Kong and cleaned up, and it was
the words that were coming out from people were that they just crushed, like couldn't keep up with demand, sold everything.
Yeah.
And this is the story of art at this time. I mean, things are humming as usual. These big art fairs are becoming more powerful, more inescapable for dealers. You can't skip out on this if you're one of these A-plus galleries. I mean, you can't.
You can if you
aspire to be one.
Anything. Yeah.
You gotta attend. So
I think that, you know, there is a political element to this, of course, that one could focus on, right? But then there's also just so much global hypocrisy when it comes to these types of things in general anyway. And I'm not trying to make excuses, but it's like the art world will scream and cry about anything so long as it's convenient to them. But then the minute that, like, it's not convenient to them, you know, then all of a sudden the screaming and the crying just goes away. And very, very conveniently, no one seemed to be too worried about human rights violations in China in whatever year we're in now. I'm losing track, 2023. But, you know, no one cared because they're too busy raking in the cash. So I wish that it's not even like, okay, I'm not even gonna ask for honesty here because Lord knows we're not gonna get honesty from these big art galleries or from most art galleries. But like, why don't they just keep their mouths fucking shut? Just shut up. You're not political activists. You're not. You're businesses. And actually, if you're a mega gallery, you're a multi-billion dollar corporation. That's actually what you are. And if you're a mid-tier or a mega minus gallery, you're most likely a multi-million dollar corporation. So you're not an activist. You're a business with a balance sheet and a bottom line, and you're there to make money. And just stop with the Kendall Jenner Pepsi Cola handing the police officer the, you know, let's make everything better by me handing you this Pepsi Cola, aka whatever art du jour we're pandering to people as, you know, the important art of the moment. Right. Like, just stop. Just shut the fuck up.
Yeah. You know, and I just checked, like, Alfonso Artiaco, Francois Gebeli, Fergus McCaffrey, Levy Gorvy, under the guise of LGDR, they all signed the pledge back then, and they all attended this year. And the boos were popping.
Long story short,
the show goes on.
The show goes on.
We teased it at the top, but Jerry has made a very big decision, and we're going to unpack it in this segment. Jerry, what are you up to?
Well, I humble bragged on Instagram. I didn't humble brag. I just announced it. I didn't tell very many people, kept it kind of close to the chest, but I threw myself into the pool, the deep end of the pool, and worked very hard on an application to go to NYU Stern Executive MBA program.
So you're going to business school.
Well, and I went through the whole process of applying, and yes, I found out 4 days ago, because that's how excited I am. 4 days ago, I found out that I was accepted, which is a very, very big deal, especially, and I hope nobody from NYU is listening to this. I'm somebody who barely passed high school because I, not out of stupidity, I think, but mainly out of like genuine disinterest for what they were teaching at the time. And I mean, I did very well in art school because I took it very serious, kind of too seriously.
I saw your transcripts from art school and it's just A's and A pluses all the way across.
Seriously.
What are some of the course names you took in art school, just to refresh me?
Oh my gosh. Well, it's funny. I took a lot of like critical theory A, critical theory B, and I took a lot of like, you know, all the feminism classes you could take, like, I took all the different like art history classes basically that the school offered. I talked my way into, technically I was a new genres major, but I, which is a multimedia cross-disciplinary degree.
Right.
But I didn't make anything yet. Right. So I was like, I just needed to feed my brain with information. So I was like deeply embedded with like the art history department and deeply embedded with like the theory side of, there wasn't like a school of theoretics, but like there was like, that was sort of part of the art history department. So I was hanging with those teachers a lot, and, you know, I'd hang out with this woman, Sharon Grace, who was also like a researcher at Stanford. So I, you know, I was like trying to trip out as hard as I could on my, you know, on the theoretical and art historical side of an art education.
And at any point during your art education, did you dabble in any business concepts in any way, shape, or form?
No.
I feel like some of our audience can empathize with that. It's something we've talked about on the podcast and then, you know, on your page for a long time. So I'll ask you, so what led to this decision? You know, why at this stage you decide you wanted to pursue an education in business at an MBA level, which is no joke.
Yeah.
Let me tell you, I did mine 2018 and it's rigorous. It's pretty intense. There are classes that are really going to challenge you, especially on the quantitative side. I mean, it's no secret that's a huge part of these courses. And it's something that you self-admit you haven't spent a lot of time doing, like statistics and accounting. But there are times where you'll take a course and you will find it's just right up your alley and you didn't expect it to. And I do feel like that's going to be the case for you. Like you'll find your school of life that your education you got will lend itself to a lot of the courses you'll take. And also, they don't want anyone failing. That's not in their business. They're not, a lot of courses are pass fail.
Right.
And they're not trying to get you booted out unless you're really messing up and not attending. You'll be fine.
Okay. Thanks for the words of encouragement. What was the question again? I can't remember.
It was, what made you want to take on this education at this stage in your life? I mean,
I think it's a natural part of my evolution as a, I'm gonna not just say an artist, I'm gonna just say as a person, but as somebody who, you know, is not easily pleased or satisfied ever.
What?
Poor Matt. But no, I mean, I'm the type of person that, you know, I'm equally as hard on myself as I am on the world and on everything else. So, you know, don't worry, guys. I'm not just giving myself the hall pass, but like I've come to an impasse with art where I'm like, okay, I see art. I see its place. I feel like I have gone as absolutely far as I can go studying the art market. You know, I could go farther in the sense that I could go and really work in it again, or like, you know, somehow transact in it. And I really don't want to do that. But I've, you know, studied the art market. I've worked like every single job in an art world. I've sort of studied like the traditional business models. I, you know, was fortunate enough to have an artist-run space in New York. I ran out of my apartment, and then I an art gallery called Hildy in LA for 2 years. And then, you know, stepped into this role of, I would say, playing or pretending, but being Jerry Gagosian, or, you know, creating this character or whatever, nom de plume, or however you want to word what I've done, doing this performance. And, you know, I think Instagram is going in some interesting places that I'm not sure I'm on board with fully. So that's one thing. And then the other thing is, you know, in my life personally, I've realized that having, and this would be a controversial statement,
buckle up.
Having access to capital, like real capital, is a very powerful position to be in, right? Having access to money. And let's just say that being a conceptual artist with a love for philosophy and theoretics, you know, not always like the easiest way to, you know, quantitatively, you know, create, you know, dinero for the pockets. But in order for me, I feel like, to enact whatever greater good I can on the planet, you know, not to sound like SBF or whatever.
Altruism.
Yeah, effective altruism.
Effective altruism. That's why Jerry's going to business school, people. She needs to learn.
Yeah.
A little EA.
It's not for effective altruistic reasons, but, you know, in order for me to have a broader impact on the world and have a bigger influence, I realized, you know, that culture is powerful. It is powerful. Of course, culture is powerful. But there's also another component that shapes the world, and that's capital. Like, there's the cultural part, and then there's the capital part. And they rub off of each other. I don't know if there's, at different times, maybe one seems to be more powerful than the other, because we've seen movements in time where there's been uprisings, and then we would say culture is more powerful, and then there's other times where, you know, it's the other way around. But I wanted to become fluent in the language of money, because it's a language, and it's a language that I don't speak. It's one that I started teaching myself over the last couple of years. Like, let's say I'm in the Duolingo phase of learning about money, right? Like I could go to France and order myself a baguette and a, you know, cup of coffee and say thank you, please and thank you, and ask how much it is and, you know, pay and walk out. But that's like the extent to which I really understand like the nuanced language of money. And I want to fully absorb, or not fully, but to whatever extent this executive MBA can offer me, I want to become fluent in this, you know. For me personally, it'll be my fourth language, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the art world has turned into the art industry, which is a cliche that's been written. And having business embedded within this system is necessarily a bad thing. It's an inevitability. It's something we talked about with Stefan Simkowitz and others. So let's not play games here. You know, when we're transacting in $1 billion worth of something, the professionalization of it is inevitable. I don't know if that means it'll lose its innocence and its culture that you're talking about.
Right.
Hope not. But this is the world that we live in. And I think your choice to gain those skills is a wise one. I don't see it as a, like, did you get any feedback from in the comments? Like, sell out. Like, what are you doing? Like, going to business school as an artist? Like, what? Did any of that stuff come up?
I only got a lot of, like, congratulations, actually. I think that if anybody, knows how hard it is to get into that school, like, actually knows how hard it is, like, they could just go suck on it. Like, you know, like, there's nothing that anyone can say, because I just went through like a metamorphosis to like get myself into a position to where a school like NYU Stern would even consider an applicant like me.
We joked about it when you applied. The type that applies to these programs are consultants and bankers and corporate people that are looking to take their skills to another place within their hierarchy that they're operating in. Very rarely, I think at all, do they get a candidate with your background, truly. Like, I imagine the admissions person, when they grabbed your application, was just like, hold on, Jerry, come over here for a second. You got to see this. Yeah, Rick, come on, check this out. Hold up. Read this.
Yeah.
Did this get misplaced? And then it starts to make sense. And I felt like that was such a powerful angle that you had with your application, is that you are so different than the other candidates. And it's an amazing accomplishment. And I'm super excited to see where it goes.
Thank you. There's so many different ways to take it. And as you've advised me, and I think it's very wise. And of course, it's like, I can't tell you where I'm going to be. They say that, like, by the end of year one, like, most of the candidates are headhunted, like, and are working for, like, major corporations. But it's within year two that you even start to decide, like, what you want to go into. Like, do you want to become an asset manager, you know, asset wealth manager, or do you want to, like, do you want to go into fintech, or do you want to go into like no, you don't really know, because like the first year they're just gonna like pound you with these terrorizing courses like statistics.
Yay.
But you know, I'm really excited actually, because I heard their statistics teachers amazing. But of course, you know, I had to refer back to Andy Warhol's The Philosophy of Andy Warhol, From A to B and Back Again. I was trying to remember what he'd said about business, or what he'd said about being art as business, business as art. And he, like, in the book, he keeps flip-flopping them, like, in the words. Like, he'll literally, like, business, art, and the next phrase, art, business, business, art, art, business. In the future, he says, you know, I no longer wish to be referred to as an artist. I wish to be referred to as a business artist. That, and, you know, this is like later in his career, in his life, that he said this. But one thing that I thought was interesting if anybody does read this book, which, you know, everyone knows I love this book. I've read it so many times. So in chapter 6, Andy Warhol says on page 92 of my copy, art is the step that comes after art. I started as a commercial artist and I want to finish as a business artist. After I did the thing called art, and he put that in parentheses or whatever it's called, I went into business art. I wanted to be an art businessman or a business artist. Being good in business is the most fascinating kind of art. During the hippie era, people put down the idea of business. They'd say money is bad and working is bad. Making money is art and working is art. And good business is the best art. And then he goes on to talk about how, you know, in the beginning of his career, you know, or in the beginning of, he calls it Andy Warhol Enterprises. He's like, you know, we were a mess. Like, the studio was a mess. And, like, we didn't really know what we were doing. It took a long time to figure out how to, like, turn it into a business. And I feel like, finally, I can kind of relate to that. You know, I know that being an artist is tough sometimes, because it's like throwing spaghetti at a wall, because there's, again, probably part of the reason I really did want something very hard and hard tools, hard skills, going to business school. But there's this nebulous with art, right? Which is like, was I born in the right time and place? Am I in fashion? Am I liked by the right people? Will I peak at the right age and the right time and, you know, have the right kind of career and make enough money and have enough of the things that I need to make even more great art? And will I ever live to see my own success? And, you know, you can go on and on with all the questions that sort of existentially hang over your head every day and is genuinely the gamble that you take as an artist, because you don't know.
Mm.
And I think that, of course, anything is possible. If, you know, a conceptual artist who had to have round two of her career be finally being an artist after giving up trying to be an art dealer, because that failed for a different reason, and I had absolutely no money, and I had to completely reinvent myself and reinvent and do all these different things to become a certain kind of artist that happened to be the what was in style at the time and spoke the language of the time, which happened to be Instagram. You know, I got lucky. I got very lucky because I could be painting, I don't know, steampunk miniatures of very,
which is good, actually. That's very, like, good stuff.
Very esoteric characters from their comic book worlds or whatever. You know what I mean? Like, and that could be my art. And like, maybe I wouldn't be here, you know, having this conversation and having an art podcast. But I got very lucky. And then slowly I was able to sort of dig myself out of the trenches and build and grow. And now I've taken on so many bigger projects and I actually have like a legitimate company. And to go back to like sort of the first question, and I think this is the best way to end it, is, you know, as an artist, I grew so much and I realized I wanted to grow more. And I realized that in order for me to grow more, I need to have better access to even more capital. And I also need to understand how money ebbs and flows and really moves in the world, and I need to speak the language of money.
Right.
And do you want to say something? And in order for me to do that, I need to go and get this education so that I can become like more of myself. And I don't think that that means like I'm not going to be an artist when I come out of business school. But it's also not a guarantee in my mind at this moment that I'm coming out of business school wanting to be what Andy Warhol calls a business artist. Oh. Or an artist or an art business woman, you know?
So for our audience, which is a lot of artists out there, a lot of working artists, do you believe that they should expose themselves to this world? I think this is a controversial topic.
Yeah.
Because you hear that some artists believe they should just focus on the work and the business should totally remain to their dealers or to their advisors or to whomever and stay out of their zone. And even some very prominent and famous artists keep that philosophy. But then there's others like, I don't know, Murakami or something that have fully embraced it, or Koons, who's running a Fortune 500 sized company at this point. So for our audience, you know, what advice would you give them about this world? Should they expose themselves to it? Should they avoid it? Should they do it only if they actually have a passion and interest for doing it? What's your take?
I think I was honest about this in my application, or at least I know I was honest about this in my admissions interview, where I said in a very polite way that I was forced into business and I was basically forced to become an entrepreneur because I came out of art school with no education whatsoever. And as I, you know, alluded to earlier, like throwing spaghetti at the wall. Along the way, like throwing spaghetti at the wall, I've learned that certain things work and certain things stick and that you can make money in certain ways. And I'm not even talking about art in the art world. I'm talking about in other things. Like I've taught myself how to be an entrepreneur. I could, you know, not be in art and go like get very, I don't know, passionate. I need to be passionate, but I could go get very passionate about, you know, selling stuffed bunnies for grown-ups and children alike to snuggle and hug that also look good on your sofa, you know, and it could get very passionate about that and go deep into that and make that my life. And I know that I could be good at it because I sort of learned so much about being an entrepreneur and I've thrown so much pasta at the wall and so much has stuck. And I think given the financial climate and something that you and I both learned recently is that you'll probably say this more elegantly than me because I'm learning this business language, but basically in the economy, we have like a depression, so to speak, like once every 7 years. We just call it something different. Like in 2008, what was it called?
Great Recession. Banking crisis.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then before that, it was the dot-com bubble burst, mm-hmm. right? And then like there's always like these different names for it, but there's just always going to be like these recessionary periods.
And they're likely built into this economic system that we have.
Right. And if that's the case and we're not Jeff Koons, we're not Fortune 500 company artists yet. You know, unless you have another job, like a day job, like you're a teacher or whatever, and you can sustain yourself, I think that being able to be an entrepreneur and at least have an open mind to like, okay, I'm an artist. I can do all these different things. Not everybody's looking. Like the art world's not paying attention to you 24/7 all the time. Like perhaps you could open and have an incredibly successful Etsy store. Like just saying, maybe not of your art, of your fine art, but you could have an anonymous, well-designed, nobody has to know it's you, highly successful Etsy store that sells something that you have designed, found a manufacturer in China, you work with them, you import these products in, you sell them yourself on Etsy, and boom, you've got a great business going for yourself.
From what I've experienced with meeting artists, they have an incredible level of entrepreneurial skills and most of them don't even know it.
Right.
You know, their ability to market themselves, for example, just through their social medias or their flyers or their gallery exhibitions, they have these innate abilities to push themselves out there and effectively market their practice. They're incredibly good with their money. I mean, at that level, right? They're budgeting for apartments in New York City, as well as a studio space and studio supplies. And they manage their time to maybe they have side gigs or something just to make money. Like this is stuff that's that's hard. This is stuff that is entrepreneurial in a way. It's hustle culture.
Yeah.
It's like, I've seen it and it's inspiring. And then as you scale up, you see artists that do create effectively with their studios a small business. And not even that small at certain levels.
Yeah,
and they have
that term? Sorry, like what is it? Like low lift, high impact? Like I think isn't that like a kind of corporate term or something?
Yeah, like with the low hanging fruit.
The one I learned was like I can't remember who I heard it from, but as soon as I heard it, I was like, I'm really gonna like you know make this like goals for for most things. So, you know, low lift, high impact. But when I think about like all the things that I have learned to do and that I know I'm capable of doing now, all the things, and there's so many. And I'm 12 years into my career, you know? Like I can very easily tap into a lot of things. I just have to let go of a certain portion of ego in my brain because I hope that whoever's listening to me, like I'm not discouraging anybody from being a full-time artist either. Like, please do not mishear me by what I'm about to say. But there's this myth in culture, especially like it's an old one and it's definitely carried through, that like if you are an artist and you're doing anything else other than just your one craft 24/7, 7 days a week, you know what I mean, 24/7, if you're doing anything else, you're not a real fucking artist.
Which is such bullshit, because the artists I see that are creating works, they dabble in music, they dabble in film. These are
food, they cook.
They have these other interests and passions, and sometimes they make money through them. And they're very multifaceted. They're not one track. And I think that should be celebrated. I think the question about how much exposure artists should have to the business side of things, to me, it falls on, there are some basic core tenets and elements that we've talked about on this podcast that art schools are not preparing artists for.
Yes.
And I think they all should be aware of things. I think simple, basic accounting, for example, right? Just to figure out, okay, the prices for my works and how to book them and how to plan and forecast and track my prices. Like a lot of artists do this intuitively, but some don't. And I think it can lead to disorganization. I think contracts and understanding basic legal frameworks. Like I do think business, I mean, I don't know if they do this. You tell me, art schools should take a consignment contract and have a full seminar course, whatever, maybe an elective or something, where they talk through what are all these terms that you're actually signing up for? You know, what does a consignment relationship really mean when you enter into one with a gallery or representation? And like, so that they can really understand these things without having a legal degree, but someone at least to tell them in plain English, like, hey, this is what it means. I met an artist who came right out of BFA, had a group show at a gallery in New York City. And the guy, the owner, it was a 40-60 split. She was only gonna get 40%. She had no idea. She had no idea about the 50%, you know, standard. And I think when I told her that and she confronted him, he was like, well, no, like this is how we do it here. And this is standard for a group show. And like, have you ever heard that? I mean, I know in certain circumstances, it might make sense for the splits to change, but by default, it's 50. And then there's special circumstances. So what I'm saying is I wish there was a way for artists to just get these basic business tenets.
Yeah, I mean, basic, come on. We're a little smarter and better than that, totally. At least. I mean, at the very least, read the Financial Times. I mean, it's actually the Financial Times.
Too expensive.
Is expensive.
Forget
we,
that.
We just canceled our subscription. Yeah, I'm kind of sad about it though, to be honest. wouldn't we have a little more money? Or Bloomberg, or also expensive, or whatever, Wall Street Journal, or, you know, but like,
get those fake emails and do free trials, yeah, and dollar exactly. trials.
But, you know, start reading about like what's going on in the world. There's a million podcasts. And because the art world is just this little like maison scene, right? That plays out. It's this fun little clubhouse where like the 0.01% of the world's wealth gets to like hang out with each other, and they use art as the excuse. But it's also a good little way to watch. It's like a blip on the radar where you're watching what's going on in the rest of the world with the rest of the world's economy. It's just like another way to watch what's happening. But if you can understand like basic, yeah, like you're saying, like tenets of like what's going on in the economy and what's going on in the world and like why like money's moving certain ways, like you can begin to like predict early on. Like I wasn't the first genius to start talking a year and a half ago about an upcoming recession, which still technically hasn't been declared, but we are basically, all of us are living under recessionary conditions. But you know, it's like if you just read or listen, and there's so much out there to listen to, it's good to just start having this type of information in addition to your art world bubble that you live in, because I think that it's precarious right now for artists to not know what's going on. And it's a little precarious, or dare I say, like dangerous, gambling, all those words kind of rolled up into one, to not have other alternatives in case, you know, you don't happen to be like on the NBA all-star roster, you know, and making millions and millions of dollars from your fine art. Mm-hmm. Like, it's okay to like take these amazing skills and gifts that you have,
which you've been developing through your art practice.
Yes.
Like they're in there. Yeah, totally.
And like, I heard this really great thing on a podcast I was listening to. It was actually, which one was it? I can't remember. Doesn't matter. But I was listening to this podcast the other day. They were talking about how they were like the smartest, they're like the smartest people have like the broadest palette for things in life, for everything, for food, for music, for like the types of entertainment they consume, for, you know, conditions under which they, yeah.
It's like that idea of an inch deep, mile wide. Like you try to be as broad as possible and dip your toes into as much things as possible. Yeah.
Yeah. And the thing about that is like, it's okay to like, I feel like I'm sort of trying to gently talk people out of a cult, because I feel like there's this cultish fear that people have of letting go and letting go of what other people in the art world will think of them and how they'll be judged and how they'll be looked at,
or how dealers will perceive it.
Yeah.
Or the gatekeeper types.
Yeah. And that to me is cult behavior. And it saddens me because it depresses, both literally and figuratively, a person's life. And also, like, it can be very self-limiting for where an artist's practice can go and develop. Because as a, you know, we'll say for now, until I graduate, we'll call myself a business artist or an art or whatever. You know, I would never have known what I am or what I could do until like my back was up against a wall.
Right.
And I think that is maybe a core fundamental difference between sort of the European system and the American capitalist system. And we do live in America, and we do live in under a capitalist, hyper-capitalist system where it's like, whether you want to or not, like it's swim or die. Like, you've got to figure out how to do it.
Right. So I think in conclusion, the advice that we want to give you guys is everyone should start a Web3 crypto project company and launch a shitcoin, and maybe you get charged by the SEC later, but don't worry about that. You'll have already taken the money and have run. All right, guys, that does it for this week's episode of Art Smack. As a reminder, we're independent, so leaving 5-star reviews and comments for us really helps out.
So I'm going to write about an art fair I didn't go to, which will be coming out this week. So if you are a subscriber at Gagosian.com, or if you would like to become one, head on over, Gogosian.com, and subscribe. $10 a month, not too bad. Get access to a huge archive of writing. And you also get invited to parties when I throw them and all kinds of different events that I do. So it's well worth your bang for your buck. And I'll go deeper and sort of more thorough on the subject of Hong Kong and what my take on all of this is.
See you guys later.
We love you.
Bye.